Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Okay, so if you were with us last week, you might remember that at the beginning of the program, I promised that I'm not going to do this for a while. And that is, I know I've been pretty heavy with having guests talking about the current presidential administration and the various facets of religion that play into policy right now. So this is it. We had a great guest last week, and he's agreed to join us again today. And then after that, we will delve into many other subjects of the spirit. Our guest last week was Dr. Mark Silk, and he writes for the Religion News Service. A little bit about Mark: he earned his degrees at Harvard, including his PhD in medieval history, and after teaching at Harvard, he became editor of the Boston Review. In 1987, he joined the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he worked variously as a reporter, editorial writer, and columnist. In 1996, he became the first director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, and in 1998, founding editor of Religion in the News, a magazine published by the center that examines how the news media handle religious subject matter. And in June 2005, he was also named director of the Trinity College Program on Public Values. This particular Trinity College is located in Hartford, Connecticut, which is where he is speaking to us from today. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Mark Silk. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Fred. Delighted to be back.
You know, the reason that we asked you to be here was about your article on how religion is not going to help the Republicans in the midterm elections. And we spoke for a half hour on all sorts of things, of course, dealing with religion and politics, but we never did get to the midterm. So I want to make sure that we do focus at least a little bit on your article, because obviously that's what inspired me to give you a call. So can you lay out a little bit of the landscape as you see it and make your case for why you say that religion is not going to be the silver bullet for a lot of Republicans in these midterms?
Well, I think the simple answer is, of the religious people who vote, you know, who are attracted to vote for Republicans, I mean, they're just not enough of them to make a difference in most places. What's happened over the past several decades really is that our politics, in a way that was totally sort of unanticipated by people who study our politics, political scientists, say in the 1970s, has become significantly bifurcated, divided along religious lines, regardless of what kind of religion you have. I mean, the United States these days is, you know, composed of about 70% of people who consider themselves, identify in some way or another as Christian. And about 5% of people who consider themselves belonging to some other faith tradition. And now about a quarter of the population, when you call them up and say, what is your religion, if any, they say none. So we call them nuns, which is not Catholic sisters, but people who say none. That number has increased really to a remarkable and unexpected degree over the past, really since 1990. Around a quarter. It was perhaps 7% in 1990, and that's with an increase in population. So you have somewhere between a tripling and a quadrupling in the proportion of the population who don't identify religiously, and non-religiously identified people tend to vote for Democrats, just as more religious. So that's at the heart of my argument. But then, of course, you know, you divide up other people, religious, very, you know, quite religious people who are not white, that is African Americans, many Latinos, Asians. They tend to vote Democratic too, regardless of how religious they are. So I think the point is, if you put all, if you put as you know, lots and lots of eggs in a religious basket, you're going to not, you will attract religious voters, but they're already voting Republican, and there's a tendency, the more people are aware of that push, these days. For at least a significant portion of the population, to push against religion and to vote the other way. And so I think that's my, that's sort of at the heart of my argument.
How about the understanding that so many people stayed home in 2016? Or I found out here in Michigan, I don't have the number right here, but an amazing amount of women, thousands of women apparently went to the polls and voted for other candidates, but left the presidential choice blank.
Well, I think that's an important, you know, sort of observation. And one of the things that we have seen, I mean, let me back up a slight bit. Well, you know, none of what I just said should be interpreted as saying, you know, everybody who votes Democratic doesn't care about religion and everybody who votes Republican does. Rather, we're talking in terms of gaps. And the way a religion, or sometimes it's called a God gap, is has been measured is if you take people, you know, the entirety of the population, you ask everybody in, say, an exit poll, how often, you know, when was the last time, you know, how often do you attend religious worship? And if you divide the population into people who say that they attend every week or more, and those who say they attend less than once a week, you know, you have the more religious and the less religious. If you just take the more religious folks, or at least those people who say they go to church once a week, which is not quite the same thing as going to church once a week. Those more religious, more observant people vote Republican by a margin of about 20 points, like, or have done that sort of 60-40 since around 2000. There have been a couple of exceptions, including possibly importantly in 2016, but that's a big gap. And, you know, we talk about a gender gap, where women tend to vote more Democratic and men vote more Republican, this has tended to be significantly larger, this God gap, than the gender gap. And so what's interesting about what you just pointed out, that women and you know, specifically in many cases, sort of suburban white women who tend to be Republicans, they were pretty unhappy with Donald Trump, and so many of them, or a good number of them, voted, decided to not cast a ballot in the presidential. I think what the Democrats are hoping for in the midterms is that those women will take their dislike of Donald Trump and apply it to the Republican Party in general. And vote for the Democrat on the thought that that the Republican Party, at least in Congress, have become sort of enablers of things about Donald Trump that they don't like, and so they will vote Democratic. Whether that happens, you know, remains to be seen. I think that's the big question.
In your article, you give a litany of all of the things that the Trump administration has done that have appealed to evangelical voters. I'm going to run down what you've got in here. The Muslim restriction, the so-called Muslim ban, where he didn't really ban Muslims, but banned people from several Muslim-majority countries, and then also Venezuela, because, God, we have so many problems with those radical Venezuelans here. Mm. He's attached himself closely to Israel's right-wing government and moved the embassy to Jerusalem, rolled back the Affordable Care Act's mandate to cover contraceptive services, promised to pick Supreme Court justices that would overturn Roe v. Wade, reversed the Obama requirement that those who object to receiving social services from faith-based providers be given secular alternatives, signed on to a religious liberty agenda, making it easier to obtain exemptions from laws protecting LGBT folks, embraced Vladimir Putin, whose hostility to an Islam and opposition to gay rights have endeared him to leading political services. In all of this, of course, he has acted in ways that may not have endeared him to evangelicals. His lifestyle, his past, his inability to apologize for his past. The only thing I think he did apologize for the grabbing statement during the campaign. He did do that, but otherwise he doesn't apologize for anything. He said that he's never had any reason to confess his sins because he just doesn't do that. My question is, I'm wondering if his performance in the White House might be transferable to candidates around the country. That is to say, do you think that we no longer care about the personal lives of possible lawmakers if they give us what we want?
Well, I think that begs the question of how much we care about the personal lives of presidents to start with. Going back to the very, I mean, a lot of people, and I don't want to downplay some of the less attractive features of Donald Trump's personal life. We could talk about that till the cows come home, but I think it's important to bear in mind that at the very beginning of the sort of rise of the religious right as a national force, the leadership made the decision to go for Ronald Reagan, who might have been attractive in various ways, but was a divorcee in a religious community that takes, looks askance at divorce, compared to Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher. So, Jimmy Carter. So I think there's always been a residual recognition, particularly when it, was somebody that you tended to like, to overlook personal shortcomings. Ideally for evangelicals, you would have shortcomings that you would then repent for and it's a great narrative in the evangelical world to declare yourself of, once a sinner and thanks to amazing grace, you're now found. As you point out, Donald Trump doesn't do that very well. George W. Bush, did a great job with that. I always thought that one of the problems that Ted Cruz had as a candidate, even though in some ways, he pushed very hard for the evangelical vote, is that if you ever listen to Ted Cruz, he never would talk about his own personal religious experience. And, he always talked about how his father had come around and, after finding Jesus had come back to the family. And that's fine, but nobody was going to vote for Ted Cruz's father. So that was a problem.
Especially since he killed JFK.
Well, there is that. but I think it's certainly true that there was a huge amount of fuss made during the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal on the part of the sort of religious right of the time to talk endlessly about the importance of, you know, moral leadership in the White House and how Bill Clinton had sort of betrayed the country by his immoral behavior and so on. I just think that was that was a convenient thing to say, but whether it was really whether it really mattered that much to the people who were saying it, I'm a little dubious of.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today is Mark Silk, and we're talking about religion and the midterms. A couple of things. First of all, we are seeing some people, and I get the impression that these upstarts who are winning these primaries and making big headlines, like in New York State and in Georgia, I believe, that and these are people who really claim to be very liberal, very progressive. They're making the headlines, but I still think, correct me if I'm wrong, enough establishment Democrats are still getting their backing and will still be in the general election, such as Governor Cuomo and the like. Do you have an observation about this, that even though that most of the time the establishment candidate is still going to be running, that there are these people who are really pushing the envelope, pushing a very progressive left-leaning envelope?
I think it's been as you suggest, a mixed picture. You might say the same thing about the Tea Party backed candidates in the Republican Party in 2010 and 2012.
Yeah, it seems just like that in reverse.
I would say so. I think, you know, in many of the cases where the insurgent progressives have won, have been in very Democratic districts where the incumbent, this wasn't true in some state legislative races in New York yesterday, last week, but I think in some of these cases the insurgent candidates haven't particularly attacked the Democratic incumbent. Joe Crowley in Queens was quite liberal, so was Michael Capuano in Boston. I mean, these were sort of pretty progressive Democrats. It was more an identity politics thing, but as a result, you didn't get the kind of ugliness in some of the Tea Party campaigns where Republicans were attacked as rhinos, Republicans in name only, by right wing people who were really attacking the other side. That hasn't been the case particularly. It's more, it's time for new leadership. This guy's, this is an old guy. There's, an implied, an old white guy who's been around too long. So I don't see the sort of evidence of the same kind of civil war within the Democratic Party that we've seen in recent years on the Republican side. So in that sense, I don't think it's equivalent to the Tea Party, but certainly there's been, it's been sort of a revolt without a lot of ill feeling so far.
I'm curious if you have any insights why the Republicans have not been able to make a substantial dent into certain minority communities who hold very conservative social views.
Well, I mean, the most obvious example of that is certainly, you would say the among African Americans who remain, pretty conservative on issues involving, gays, lesbians, LGBT folks, and I think likewise, conservative on abortion, at least to some degree. I think the answer is sort of the reverse of what we were, we've talked about country club Republicans who are willing to overlook conservative social issue concerns of their religious right allies because they care about money. I think for minority groups, they recognize that they have a much bigger stake in the social safety net and questions of, the ability of the government to deal with and support poverty efforts and so anti-poverty efforts and so on, that they remain connected to the Democratic Party and the agenda, and the Republicans have just not been able to break through that. And I think, the other thing is, particularly in recent years and in the Trump era, the kind of not very disguised willingness of the president to appeal to pretty frankly racist elements of the population, that's hardly going to endear him to racial minorities, and to the extent that the Republicans as a whole have bought into the have become the party of Donald Trump. It's going to, this isn't going to change anytime soon.
Let's talk about the Jewish voters right now. So you mentioned in your article that Orthodox Jews, they're pretty much going to stay where they are, voting Republican for the most part. That's pretty much it.
I don't see that changing. The Orthodox component of the Jewish population or stream is a relatively small one. I mean, it's around 10, maybe 15%. It's growing somewhat because Orthodox tend to have larger families, more babies. But it's still a relatively small minority of the entire Jewish vote. But they, on a number of grounds, on some social conservative grounds, on support of Israel, on generally, what conservatives see as religious liberty issues, they've become pretty strong Republicans, and they'll stay that way. But the rest of the Jewish world community remains, very Democratic and shows no sign of changing either.
Do you have any numbers, any data whatsoever that indicate the support of the change from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in terms of where our embassy is? You have any idea how Reform and conservative Jews reacted to that? Because I realize that once you get into that community, you have a tremendous diversity. Well, you always have. When you got Jews, you got diversity of opinion. I know that. But specifically in those communities, I'm curious if a number of them said, I don't like this Trump guy, but that's a good move.
I think I don't have hard numbers on that. My, at least I can't recall any. There may be some survey stuff out there. In general, my sense is that the position of the Jewish community as a whole, and sort of non-Orthodox, is that, it's fine to move the embassy there, but not a particularly high priority, and if it undermines you know, the sort of ability to establish some kind of good relationship with, you know, peace in that part of the world, then it's not worth it. You know, it's been interesting how little, you know, fuss and concern the decision to move the embassy has elicited anywhere. I mean, that's true in the Arab world. I mean, there have been some, you know, there were some pro forma sort of objections, but, you know, among the issues to deal with, it's a rather modest one. And to tell you the truth, I mean, you know, it was, you know, there was always a presence, you know, from the beginning of the establishment of the State of Israel, the Israelis treated, you know, before the Six-Day War, before the Israeli control over the Temple Mount, the holy sites in East Jerusalem, you know, the Israeli capital, the Knesset building, the Supreme Court, all of that was in West Jerusalem. The reason, the technical reason for not, you know, for not having embassies there, and there were more embassies and they were moved out, was that Jerusalem was, you know, itself was supposed to be part of a final peace settlement, and until that was done, you know, there was the formal diplomatic thing, but it was a diplomatic nicety. So I think that overall Jews were, you know, not unhappy to have the embassy there, but just not that big a deal.
Mark, we're down to the wire for this edition of Common Threads. I want to thank you so much for your time today and last week as well. It's been great.
Well, I've had a lot of fun, Fred, and good luck with the show. And, you know, I can understand why you wouldn't want to keep this up forever. The midterms will be on us soon enough.
Exactly. I'm Fred Stella. Common Threads is the show. WGVU-FM is the place. And I want to thank Mark Silk, our guest today. And you can read his musings and his brilliant insights at Religion News Service. And we'll talk to you next week.